Before beginning this episode, we would like to present our new offering, the Climate Finance Course. The Climate Finance Course is a self-paced and detailed online course covering all aspects of financing climate initiatives and technologies. This course aims to be the world's most comprehensive course on climate finance, covering topics such as climate tech venture capital, ESG and sustainable finance, renewable energy finance, and nature-based finance. Enrolling in this course will give you a deep understanding of the historical evolution, concepts, tools, case studies, public policies, data, and much more on climate finance. This critical knowledge will allow you to enable climate impact. So go ahead and purchase this course at www.climatefinancecourse.com. I repeat, www.climatefinancecourse.com. Welcome to the Climate Finance Podcast. My name is Jonas, and this podcast aims to mainstream climate finance by interviewing high-level investors, researchers, and policymakers who have made significant contributions to the climate finance space. Please note that this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as investment advice. Enjoy the episode. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. Welcome back to the Climate Finance Podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Shivaram Rajgopal. Dr. Rajgopal is a professor at Columbia Business School. He has previously held professorship positions at Duke University, Emory University, and University of Washington. He has over 200 academic publications and over 100 plus publications on Forbes, focusing on accounting, auditing, ESG, governance, financial reporting, fraud, valuation, exit compensation, short-termism, corporate culture, technology, and fiscal responsibility. So welcome, Professor. How's it going in New York?
Oh, my God. I hope I can live up to a lofty introduction. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. It's an honor to have you on this podcast. While researching for this interview, I'm curious to hear about your origin story, especially since you studied accounting. I've had two Indian origin interviews before, and they all studied accounting, and the next one might also all study accounting. So it's interesting that they're all chartered accountants. But then you had a few years of work experience, and then you did your PhD focusing on the oil and gas sector. So could you please delve into that?
Oh, my, that is such an interesting way to start a podcast, right? Most people just start with some policy question or something. This is fascinating. So when I was growing up in India, essentially we had three career choices only. So you could either become a doctor, you could become an engineer, or you could become an accountant, by and large. And to become a doctor and or an engineer, you had to be reasonably wealthy because a couple of things. One, getting into the IITs, et cetera, was super competitive. And of course, I never tried, so I don't know whether I would have ever made it or not. Who knows? But for folks who are not familiar, IIT is the Indian Institute of Technology. It's a pretty elite institution, fairly hard to get into. Most of the well-known Indians have some affiliation to IIT or IIM, which is the Indian Institute of Management. I'm not affiliated to either of them. But coming back to the point here, those were relatively risky and high capital intensive endeavors, coming back to the language of economics. So this was the easy option, if you will, partly because my father died pretty young. So I was basically like 15 and a half or 16 or something. So going down the other path was actually harder for me financially. So people often say, how can you be engaged or interested in accounting? It's such a boring topic. I think that's a total myth. As long as you are immersed in something, you can A, make it interesting and or find interesting aspects there to communicate to the other. So people almost undervalue accounting, because it's effectively the science that helps you understand how information and money flows in the business. It's the lifeline of a company or any enterprise. Doesn't even have to be a for-profit enterprise. In fact, non-for-profit enterprises arguably are worse managed, because ultimately the one big problem we are trying to solve as humans is the problem of scarce resources. Whether it's money, whether it's carbon budgets, the principles are not that different. So how did I end up working on oil and gas in accounting? So around the time I was graduating, derivatives in the U.S. were becoming a big issue. Risk disclosures were becoming a big issue. This is like financial risk disclosures, not the kind that we talk about in the ESG climate world. And even now, frankly, that hasn't been resolved, because the issue was, should you talk about inputs to risk, or should we talk about risk expressed as, say, dollars? And maybe in the banking world, for instance, you see things like value at risk disclosures, meaning how much value will, say, the trading portfolio lose based on some statistical probability models of how the values fluctuate over a day or something. Right? And the SEC had put out some data or requirements at that time saying that a company had to tell you, if there's a 1% change in some market risk, defined as, say, interest rate risk or commodity prices or even currency, how responsive would the company's earnings or cash flows or sometimes fair values be based off of those sensitivity metrics? And that's what I studied in the context of oil and gas, because the nice thing about oil and gas is that you could both figure out the commodity price risk, it's very, very obvious, and to some extent, the operational risk. The idea being that you dig 10 wells, and then 9 of them turn out to be useless. And then the 10th well happens to be a gusher, a big something that pays off for the cost of the other 9 wells. And funnily enough, then the world evolved, and technology is no different. Netflix, for instance, has the exact same business model. No, they don't know which show is going to hit, so they have to make the 10 shows, and hopefully the 10th one is going to be the, you know, the House of Cards or the whatever, Black Mirror, Stranger Things, etc., etc. So if you look for it, the parallels across business models are all there. So it goes back to my earlier comment. If you're immersed in what you're doing and you abstract away and think about parallels, there are many parallels. So maybe I'll stop there. So maybe that's a longer origin story that you're probably expecting.
No, it's very good. And while you finished your PhD at University of Iowa, you published a few articles related to oil and gas and SEC, but you also started dabbling into technology literature. If you can look back in retrospect around the IPO boom in 1999, especially now we had the SPAC boom, or maybe the SPAC bust, and also the SVB crisis. How do you think about it at this point in time?
So it's interesting. So I dabbled in tech because I was always interested in working on applied things. So half the reason I got a PhD was to hopefully try to respond to questions that people have, either in policy or practice. The world of academia is not structured that way. It's strange, but the notion of an ivory tower is pretty true. People basically just shut themselves off and try to, in my mind, come up with answers to questions that no one has. So I was always interested in applied things, for which I paid a fairly big career price, I must say. The mandarins who are the powers to be obviously want things done the way they've been doing things. So maybe that's what stoked the rebellious gene in me as well, to go down this path. But coming back to your question at hand, that's fascinating. So in my career, I've at least seen 3 or 4 such busts. And they seem to happen with increasing regularity around like 6-7 years. So I graduated with a PhD around 98. And then we had the biggest tech booms of our times, maybe 99. And then there was a tech crash in 2000. And then things were motoring along for a while. And then, of course, we had the buildup to the housing crisis, 2008. And that was a game changer, as you can imagine. And then quantitative easing happened. Interest rates were cut to almost 0 for the longest time, which obviously sowed the seeds for the next crisis, because we had overvalued stock markets, passive indexing took off, option compensation skyrocketed because equity became a big thing. Finally, perhaps all that sadly culminated in the virus, the 2020, the coronavirus problem. Then markets crashed. And then, of course, there was more quantitative easing, hoping to kind of address that problem. And then that created supply side inflation. So my point here being, these cycles seem to happen quite often these days. The other problem is, we are all condemned to live a particular slice of history. And this is the other thing I complain about a lot in our classrooms. I don't think we teach people enough economic history. A lot of the problems we are trying to solve today, somebody else has probably thought about. They may not be the exact same problem, but the kernel of the problem has perhaps been discussed earlier. And it's useful to at least go and understand what the great minds of that time came up with as a response to the problem they faced at that time. But having said that, so easy money is like the theme here, at least in that small slice of economic history that we discussed. The tech crisis was a localized crisis. It didn't bring the whole world down in some sense. Finance, on the other hand, had a far bigger footprint. and affects so many things in unmodeled, difficult to understand ways. And a lot of my work deals with micro activities. How do companies behave? How do institutions work? And there's a fairly, I think, big disconnect between the macro, where central bankers and the people who work on big picture things like interest rates and unemployment, etc. And many of them are, I'm amazed, you know, they live in the world of model. Empirical data in that field is sadly not as used as it should be compared to the micro world, where there's a lot of empirical data. So this idea of falsifying theories, etc., people live in the world of model. In the world of math. So my hope, and hopefully we'll get into this later in the talk as well, that is somehow we can make the macro models a little less abstract, make them come down to earth a little bit, and take the richness and the granularity of the micro world to make the macro models a bit more rich and granular. Fully understanding that once you start zooming out, the details fade away. But the problem is that the important details are fading away. And people are increasingly generalizing the unimportant details from the micro setup. So how are they different is your point. They're all a reaction to easy money. They're not that different. The players have been different. But in fact, I think I sent this to my dean. She ran a class where we teach people about the history of fraud. You can go back to the tulip mania. You can even go back further. And there are patterns over and over and over again. So it's learning some economic history is very fruitful. As an endeavor.
Speaking of patterns in economic history, one important case was Enron. And you've written some articles about it in 2005. And then in the last year, you wrote an article, Did Investor Interest in Financial Reporting Peak with Enron? So I'd be curious because Enron is related to climate in some form or way.
No, very interesting because the CFO of Enron, who went to jail, Andy, actually comes and speaks to my class every year. It's a phenomenal talk. There's no revisionist history. He doesn't make excuses. And the big point he makes is that, you know, we've come to a world where anything that's not explicitly banned is implicitly allowed. In the sense, lawyers and investment bankers and accountants, in many cases, have become enablers of, you know, nipping and tucking, engineering around to get some short-term desired outcome. So, and you can see parallels of that even in the greenwashing climate issue. So Enron was a watershed moment. If you just stick to the financial reporting idea here, of course, it changed. I mean, it brought in Sarbanes-Oxley, which some people argued was imposed too much cost. All that regulatory debate, it's almost a reflex action now. I can even write a checklist of how to complain about any regulation. It's compliance costs. It makes the U.S. uncompetitive. It'll add proprietary costs, meaning it'll force me to reveal private information. We don't need this. This is a solution looking for a problem. It's like standard stuff, which gets discussed over and over again, unfortunately. The remarkable thing is that when senior leaders come and make these statements, nobody holds them to account. They'll say, did this really happen? I mean, you really believe that the consequences would be as dire if we get a new audit and spend $500,000 anyway. So coming back to the climate parallel here, but before that, I guess you were asking about financial statements. See, I think what happened around that time and later, especially with interest rates going down and maybe technology becoming big, technology eats everything, right? This is the Mark Andreessen comment. In the world of finance, I think to a great extent, it ate active investing. That's well known by now. So passive took off massively. Passive investing is very, very big. Passive investing, by and large, doesn't do any fundamental work on how does the company do, et cetera. The hope is that somebody else is doing that. And the question is, who is that somebody else? So passive effectively assumes that markets are efficient, but somebody has to make the markets efficient by trading. Long-term active as a asset class is probably, I don't want to say extinct, but not a serious threat. And as a result of that, one has to wonder who keeps managers honest. So the disconnect between the owner and the manager has become even more pronounced since the days of Enron. Since you asked Enron, I often sometimes joke in class that in today's world, if Enron were part of an index, we wouldn't have an Enron. Enron did what it did because it didn't have capital. It was basically a below investment grade company that was kind of fudging its books, trying to make the debt look better and hence fool the rating agencies and hence get an above investment grade rating and hence get a lower cost of debt. But, you know, if you're on an index today, if you're part of the S&P 500 or so on, you and I, because of our pension investing, are sending checks every month because of dollar cost averaging and so on. So if the money keeps coming, the capital keeps coming, which obviously means the demand for your stock is high, which in turn means your price on average tends to be higher. Why should I do any of the stuff that the Enron people did? The capital is here. So that's probably one way to connect Enron, what's happened since in the last 20 odd years, the rise of passive, arguably the organic beginning of the so-called ESG movement, which I often say is mostly about accountability. And one of the contributing drivers there is the idea that, you know, if I've given you capital, and I think we should think about capital in a broader sense, not just financial capital, natural capital, human capital. As a manager, what have you done with this capital? That's the whole stewardship notion. You're a steward of a company or an institution. How well have you lived up to your stewardship mandate? That's the G part of ESG, which frankly doesn't get discussed as much. We talk a lot about E. And going back to your question, I often say, there's like a $40 trillion lobby of assets under management who want climate disclosures from companies. I don't think there's even a $1 trillion lobby who cares about what happens in financial statements in a 10K. So the whole market of who reads statements, etc., is increasingly a problem. And as an accounting professor, I often complain about it because I don't see anybody even writing about financial reporting, by the way. So on Forbes, when I write a piece on financial reporting, I get maybe 20% of the hits and the view that I would on, say, sustainability reporting. So that's the market test for interest, right? In who cares? I think very few people care, unfortunately. And that only makes managers more powerful, and it takes away monitoring. So I often argue that there are only two institutions in the broad continuum of our capital markets that keep managers honest. The short sellers, who are usually worried about overvalued stock, and the activists, as in, you know, Dan Lowe, you know, Elliott Advisors, and so on, like Nelson Peltz, etc., who worry about undervalued stock because they try to get in, change management, increase value. And if these two relatively unpopular institutions, right, short sellers and activists, if they are missing, then I'm not sure who's going to keep valuations somewhat honest. I mean, the hedge funds do a lot of work. I'm not sure how many of them are patient capital. You know, many of them are probably getting in and out, have short-term, they kind of arbitrage away short-term mismatches in asset prices. But looking at fundamental, holding positions for a long time, all the stuff that we used to do back in the 90s and the 2000s, is increasingly a dying breed of investors.
You mentioned mostly private actors. Well, I would like to ask you about public actors, more specifically on the SEC. I saw that in the 2010s period, you published on the SEC's effectiveness, but also on the employee incentives, if I can put it that way. Some really good publications on that, especially regarding stock picking skills. But more recently on Forbes, you've been quite active of the climate disclosures approach that the SEC should take. So what's your thoughts about the SEC in general?
So stepping back, the textbook answer to this problem is actually quite simple. It's a carbon tax. You know, I mean, look at the amount of tax that we impose on a pack of cigarettes, right? It's an externality, meaning if you smoke, fine, it's your decision, but please don't poison everybody else in the neighborhood, right? So that's why we impose a tax. It's the exact same point with carbon, right? But the political situation in the US is such a nightmare. I mean, a speaker just got ousted as we are recording this. So we are trying very hard to create an as-if carbon tax environment without actually having one. So we are trying to name and shame people. This is part of the ESG idea, the negative screening, trying to rate them. All that by and large is fine, but it is not really going to be effective. So my point is, unless there is some kind of regulation, this is almost like asking a tobacco company to voluntarily pay a tax so because you actually hurt people and it creates passive smoking. Does that have any chance of going anywhere, right? It's somewhat similar here. Now, let's come back a little bit to the SEC. So my earlier statement was about all regulators, but the SEC is a disclosure regulator. The only tool the SEC really has is to force companies to disclose something, right? So my worry is that we are also overdoing, first of all, we forget that that's all the SEC can do. The SEC is not the entire United States government. It is not a taxing authority. That can only be done basically by Congress. And because Congress is deadlocked, because there's so much of this red state, blue state fight, if you will, about climate and sustainability and so on, what have we done? We can either tax your way out of this or you can incentivize your way out of this. So that's what we've done as a country, because the US is a rich country. So we have the IRA, and we are giving people incentives and so on. But coming back to the SEC in particular, all it can do is force people to disclose. And if they do disclose, they do put something out, which I'm sure is coming pretty fast, if nothing else, because the election cycle is coming up. So they're going to run up against that clock. It'll immediately get litigated. And as the California governor just passed, arguably a bill fairly similar and probably even more stringent than what the SEC would have people do, which is loosely the TCFD framework plus scope 1, 2, and 3 and some verification. So it's a pretty stringent bill in California. Europe is doing something similar. And I know these are fairly expansive bills. If you operate in California or operate in Europe, you're kind of subject to this rule. So it's interesting to see what the SEC, how, if any, what would the impact of this California bill be. But the California bill will also get litigated, because if you go back in history, they did something similar about directors, if you remember. I think they said you have to have either one or two female directors or directors of color. That got challenged and probably got, I'm guessing, thrown out. Something similar will happen to the climate bill. So forgetting all the details, the big point is that the SEC has a limited role. Even if you get full reporting, the bigger climate concern is that we are not decarbonizing fast enough. And hopefully, I don't know what the theory of change is, but let's say you do all kinds of great reporting and somehow that'll result in decarbonization. Maybe not. The only model of change I see is that maybe if you make people measure and report, perhaps you can tax. So I often say income is well measured by economies because there is by and large an income tax. GDP is well measured because, loosely speaking, GDP is value add. So you have a good value add tax. Sales is well measured because you have a sales tax. Perhaps one way to think about all the measurement and reporting activity that we are hoping the SEC will put out or require is perhaps a precursor, perhaps, to a carbon tax, subject, of course, to all the politics working out.
Speaking of carbon tax, you've written about the oil and gas sector, and you had an interesting article this year. What if both sides of the ESG debate are right about ESG, U.S. majors or oil and gas investments, but for the wrong reasons? Important caveat. And you've been known for being a pragmatist in this sector. So I'd like to know your thoughts about ESG and oil and gas.
Yeah, so big picture points about ESG and oil and gas, right? I think we're almost overdoing the pressure on supply as opposed to demand, right? So the consumer side of this conversation is by and large underemphasized or ignored. So for instance, I mean, I'm sitting on fossil fuel. So I'm sitting on a plastic chair. So I have a cotton shirt on. Oh yeah, I have an Apple Watch. Part of that is fossil fuel. The headphones I'm using are based on plastic and so on. So is there any appetite from the consumer's side to change his or her behavior? Question number one. I'll give a couple of data points. One, if you look at the number of new pieces of clothing the world generates in a year, it's something like 150 billion, B, not M, B. There are 8 billion people on planet Earth. I know this is like a gross exaggeration, but let's say everybody is equally wealthy. Each of us is consuming 20 new pieces of clothing a year. And is that behavior going to change in the short run? Second, I listened to an interview of one of the Amazon distribution center workers. And Amazon's been in the news for the wrong reasons. So these people have bad working conditions, etc. There were reports that sometimes they don't even get bathroom breaks, that they have to pee in a bottle and so on. So then somebody in the audience, I think, or the interviewer asked this lady who was one of these workers, how do you shop? And she says, of course, I buy stuff on Amazon. So the point here being, I mean, this person's being interviewed for being a critic of Amazon and thinks horribly about the working conditions, but even she can't change what she does. So the consumption part of oil and gas is ignored, is my point. And unless we give consumers a reasonable alternative to oil, and I know that's being done with electric vehicles, with its attendant problems, of course. I mean, overdoing the pressure on the supply side of oil and gas, one has to wonder about the wisdom of that, right? There are a couple of other points. If you really want Chevron and Exxon and so on to become renewable companies, I mean, is that even their core competence? Most of the innovation perhaps is going to come from a company like Tesla, an upstart, which we probably aren't even thinking about today, right? So the third point, even if we, let's say, somehow stop getting all the Western oil majors to function, unless the consumption side of this is managed, the production of oil will simply migrate to countries, you know, who know who they are, which may or may not be friendly to the US or the Western interests. So, I mean, I can understand some of the anger and the pressure and so on. And there's a fourth point, which, so thankfully in my climate risk class at Columbia, I'm so happy that I often have students from Asia and Africa. So when one side of the student body is obviously making arguments that oil and gas just needs to shut down and so on. I mean, that's another thing to worry about, right? I mean, if you're sitting in Africa or India, I mean, yeah, my per capita consumption of carbon is nothing. And then, so there's a trade-off between the GDP growth that oil and gas bring versus the cost of remediating these things. How do you deal with these issues, especially in the non-rich world? Perhaps adaptation is frankly the only hope. Mitigation is very difficult, unless you're talking about the G7, because they have the wealth to do these things. So the attendant conversations about climate justice, etc. I mean, I see the moral arguments there. Is it pragmatic to expect Western countries to actually give large sums of money to the global South? It's never going to happen. Foreign aid itself has had all these issues. Is this even the right thing to do, etc.? So setting those economic and moral arguments aside, it's probably not going to happen, right? So yes, it's good to put pressure on the Western countries and so on. Maybe some kind of transfer of technology is a better idea, perhaps, as opposed to asking for reparations. So just to come back and maybe summarize, we are all to blame, right? So unless we fix consumption, and I know, you know, people will often say, oh, this is like saying, you know, Pepsi says people don't exercise enough. It's not me that gives the people diabetes. I see that point, but I think this is a bit different from Pepsi. In Pepsi's case, you can voluntarily not consume Pepsi because it's sugar water. Can I really get by any day without consuming any kind of plastic or any kind of petroleum product or any kind of chemical? It's virtually impossible, even if I try very, very hard. Right? The computer that enables this conversation is, a lot of the casing is plastic for us. I don't know. I'm not trying to be pragmatic. I just often tell people that, look, I'm from a very poor country where resources were a big problem when we grew up. They still are in India.
We can't afford to very strong ideological priors because we have to survive and just get there.
So a lot of my sensibility perhaps comes from that space. Sometimes I'm amazed when very rich people on both sides kind of get entrenched in certain ideological positions and they go at it.
Speaking of ideological positions, I'd like to now move on to ESG strategies that might be employed by certain investors from, let's say, ritual countries. First off, screening. You've written an article, does ESG negative screening work? And at the second ESG strategy, shareholder engagements. And you wrote the three big, this in brackets, engagements. Yeah. So what are your thoughts about those ESG strategies?
So it's a good point. I often tell people it's a subtle position. Increasingly, people don't have patience for subtle positions these days. But I'll anyway try to put this out. ESG as an idea is brilliant. I think it's fantastic for three reasons. So we touched on a few of these before. One, if you look at an income statement, in general, we seem to assume that the cost of natural capital consumed by a company is mostly zero. I don't know how to value natural capital very well, but it is not zero. I know that. So that's one proposition. The second proposition is that the reporting model does a very bad job in general of measuring both positive and negative externalities. We talked about negative externalities, the passive smoking, the emissions. We haven't talked as much about positive externalities. Now, this whole conversation is made possible by, you're using some fancy software, but let's say it's Zoom. What's the license fee we pay to Zoom? Like, I don't know, 100, 200 bucks a month, a year. But the value that Zoom adds, or Teams, not partial to a brand, is phenomenal. So a lot of the positive value that businesses generate through innovation is not captured by the business. It's actually spread to society. So think of that as positive externality. We don't measure and manage that well. And the last point, when the link between the manager and the owner becomes frayed or dissipated, then like indexing, accountability issues come in. So those are three or four big ideas that I think ESG is wonderful about articulating and advocating. The practice of ESG, which is what you're raising, is a mess, right? So the only real way in my mind to make progress is rigorous, authentic measurement. I'll give you one example, but it is not ratings. But so consider a vision where, let's say you create something like a stakeholder value add statement. Right now, the reports we put out are usually shareholder value add at best, right? You have like revenues, costs, expenses, taxes, income. So keeping that framework in mind, for revenues, let's think about consumer value add. For cost of goods sold, materials, let's think about, say, supplier value add. For labor costs, let's think about employee value add. And I'll try and expand on that in a minute to just show you what I mean. And then let's think of, say, a taxpayer value add.
You know, how much am I giving by way of taxes of all kinds, and how much am I getting back in terms of grants, subsidies? Many of these are hidden, not even clear. For instance, an industrial company in the US pays about half for power that a residential customer pays. But that's like one small example. There's so many examples where we subsidize companies, which doesn't get accounted for in reports. So just to pick up on one idea there, employee value add. So imagine a world where you're working for Apple Computers or Apple Inc. They're paying you $200,000, let's say. Your next best alternative in terms of a job is, say, $150,000. So think of 200 minus 150, that $50,000 as the value that Apple is adding to you as an employee. That's what I mean by employee value add. And again, this is like elementary economics. You always look at the next best alternative. What do you do right now? I work for Apple. What's my next best alternative? Let's say the next job in Palo Alto, whatever that is, for your skill set, is say 150. So where am I going with this? So once you compute this across the whole company, you can come up with employee value. And you can think of a x-axis and a y-axis, where on the y-axis, you compute, say, shareholder value add, profits plus some minus some cost of capital. And in a world where you have a completely participative culture, in a company, in terms of money, the thinking would be if shareholder value add goes up by, say, 10%, maybe employee value add should also go up by something, by maybe 10%. So in an ideal world, in our X and Y axis, for participative cultures, those companies should show up on the 45-degree diagonal. So when we ran this with some data, and disclosures are a bear, but setting that aside for a second, we did the best we could. Who shows up on that diagonal? Mostly banks, because they have a fairly robust bonus culture. You know, the bank makes trading money, the employees make money. Some of the unionized shops show up, like UPS and Costco, which may not mean much to you if you're not US-based, but it's a very popular discount retailer. Consumers love Costco, employees love Costco. So the idea is that here there's no black box. It's hopefully motivated by some theoretical thinking and rigor. How does ratings work right now? I mean, it's like it's a total mess. It's like adding 1 point for you're wearing a brown shirt today and I'm wearing a blue shirt, subtract 1 point. How can it predict anything? So I'm amazed how obsessed investors are with rating, because somehow I think it makes their headache go away. This is a difficult problem. If you just want plausible deniability that some vendor sold me these ratings, then fine. Okay, I think most folks are probably doing that. I see very little investment in actually pushing the boundaries in terms of measuring the things that you really want to measure. Now, coming back to your question about negative screening. So what's the idea behind negative screening, right? I'm not going to invest in, say, tobacco or weapons or whatever. And the theory is that somehow it hurts them. So the point we make in that paper was that it's not even obvious that it hurts them. So if you don't hold a tobacco company, they don't need your capital because they have retained earnings. They're not expanding anyway. So negative screening is a real thing. The proportion of so-called sin stocks held by institutions has fallen quite dramatically over time. But the problem, Jonas, in capital markets, is that, at least in equity markets, is that they're very deep and very liquid. And there is somebody else sitting in some basement, or as in special purpose entity, you don't even know who's buying, but somebody is buying the stock if you're selling. And if we go down this path too much, they will all go private and effectively simply get out the disclosure / regulatory umbrella anyway, which is going to happen already with oil and gas companies. Right? So with negative screening, A, I'm not sure you really heard the intended party. B, you lose a seat at the table, you cannot engage. It is better to hang around and complain. That's a better theory of change rather than just selling, because it'll simply be held by people who have no reason to complain. So maybe you're right. I think you said, maybe is this ideological? Perhaps it makes you feel good, which is the other big point we should make in the space. I see very little by way of what does success look like? Conversations, right? Is success simply not holding this? That's easy, right? That's not success. Which brings me to the paper we just wrote, the big three's engagement strategies. So while I was writing a piece for Forbes, I accidentally stumbled on very detailed data that BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street now have started publishing in terms of who did they engage with, like thousands of companies. So we just, you know, me and fellow partners in crime, there's a law professor at Northwestern called Rubal, and there's Lubo Litov, who's a finance professor at Oklahoma. So we just scraped the data and ran some simple empirical diagnostic tests. You know, who do these people go after? Meaning Vanguard, BlackRock, State Street. What happens when they go after them? Does the stock price move? Does anything change? And by and large, the answer is disappointing. There's nothing really going on. So the first thing I would have looked for is if there are companies in the index which are like chronic underperformers, you know, I would create a SWAT team to go after them, you know, because you can't get rid of them because they're part of the index. If you really want to engage, and this will be good for everyone, right? If you indeed manage to improve governance practices, the value will be released for everyone. CalPERS used to do this. CalPERS used to put out a so-called blacklist. They've stopped doing that. So I've started putting out mine. You must have read that on Forbes. There are like 37 companies on the S&P 500, which haven't even earned what a Treasuries ETF, meaning a short-term bonds, US Treasuries bond ETF would have earned over the last 10 years. 10 years, okay, it's a lot of time. It's not just 1 year, not COVID. You can't say it's like exception, blah, blah, blah. But if you look at their proxy statements, and these are like very well-known companies, AT&T, IBM, Continental Petroleum, Halliburton, the PG&E, Citicorp, there's not much going on in terms of so-called governance. I mean, the board looks fabulous. There's a skill matrix and everything looks great. Compensation, I mean, by and large, comp consultants decide for a company of this size, the CEO gets whatever, 20, 25 million. That's the place where, you know, the big three can add value. But surprisingly, we didn't find any of that. It is not even obvious that they are adding value in the ESG space, as in, have emissions really gone down? There's a paper that claims that it does go down, but when we look and kind of relook at the data, we don't find anything. Do women on boards go up? Kind of not all that much. So the big point, again, going back to the theme here, what does success look like if you're part of the big three and you're engaging with so many companies, right? Is something that's worth thinking about. So going back to the other point, I think ESG as an idea is superb. The practice is a mess, to kind of summarize. And there are lots of places where one can point to flawed practice. And I've written so many pieces. You know, greenwashing is almost the norm. It's quite difficult to find a truly sustainable company. And my friends in investment banking say there are such companies. And they'll usually give me one or two examples. I'd like to see at least 100 out of the 5,000 stocks trading in the US in the public domain. Now, granted, in the private domain, it's a bit easier because you can actually influence what the manager does. Otherwise, think about this, right? What is the theory of change here? You own 0.02% of Apple. Why should the Apple CEO listen to you? So the whole idea of how shareholders engage with companies in the US is very constrained because of this proxy process, which is another issue to think about and worry about a bit.
You're well known for your research regarding index funds, ETFs, mutual funds, but I would like to do a rapid fire round of other investment asset classes, which you've written on Forbes. So let's kick it off with private equity. You've written an article recently, does private equity have an ESG problem? So what's your thoughts on private equity?
So when we were in graduate school, and even now, I mean, I'm just teaching a PhD seminar, so much is written about how regulations back, being private is fantastic because there's no agency problem, right? So like everyone else, I've drunk that Kool-Aid as well. And I want to believe there's good private equity and bad private equity, except it is the disclosures are so opaque that it's very hard for an outsider to know. Right, private equity has just become a huge thing now. You know, it's like roughly 13 trillion odd, you know, assets under management. It's still small compared to passive, but it'll only grow. And of course, you need some private equity, partly because, you know, family firms want to sell out. There are small firms where they have an interesting product, but their management practices are not up to snuff and so on. So that's where private equity can really add value. But private equity is increasingly not private. A lot of the money is now coming from public pension funds who I'm guessing are not as inclined to push private equity about ESG as they are in the public domain. I mean, many of them make a lot of noise in the public domain about ESG. So, you know, it's just usually the state and the municipal and other pension funds. Less worried, I'm guessing, about private equity because they're so desperate for yield and returns, which private equity offers. And even that is subject to debate, by the way. Some people have argued that the so-called IRR, which the private equity folks give after expenses, doesn't even necessarily beat the market. there are questions. I'm not saying all private equity is bad, but some more transparency along those lines would help, because private is not really private, is the point. If that's the case, fine. You don't have to tell us anything.
Speaking of private equity firms are well known for taking on a lot of debt. And you've written two interesting articles regarding debt products. One is Debt Finance ESG on Forbes, and the second one is Rethinking the Value and Emissions Implications of Green Bonds.
Okay. So debt, I think, as a financing vehicle, has more power to track on specific outcomes, unlike equity. We don't have covenants in equity, right? And because the proxy process is so inefficient as a way to get investors and managers talking, debt's actually more effective, because you can write a contract saying, if you do not do this, then I will increase your interest rate by X or whatever. So the value of that covenant is actually, it has tremendous potential, is my point, if you want to do anything debt-based. And again, it's a private contract. The debt holders are telling you to do something. The company is taking money voluntarily to do that thing. So it's okay. You know, so how can anybody complain about how this is imposing values and so on? Green bonds paper is interesting because the green bonds as an asset class have taken off quite a bit. And of course, the inevitable question, and so much of my work is about, do they walk the walk and talk the talk? So it was kind of inevitable to go check. And there are papers that claim that after a year, emissions fall. We don't find anything. If you expand the window to 2 years or 3 years, there's nothing. Which is the other problem, I think, generally I should talk about. Two problems in this space. One, a lot of scholarly work in ESG doesn't replicate, which I think is not good. Because if we are in the business of policing integrity, then we have no business to put out stuff that doesn't replicate. The second problem is, you know, both sides, I think, end up overstating their case. You know, the pro-ESG side and the anti-ESG side. By and large, reality lies somewhere in the middle. So for whatever reason, they both have different incentives to overstate their case. So bottom line with green bonds, there's something going on. There's a little bit of a green premium. It's quite small once you control for other things like liquidity factors and so on. Does it really achieve green outcomes? Not really. I'm not sure. Pretty hard to show. And it could simply be because companies are not decarbonizing fast enough, which is the other problem in this space, right? Despite so much work and activity, advocacy, finance, ESG, hearings, ratings, that whole industrial complex that we've now built, it's a sad reality that decarbonization is very slow.
Next up, REITs, Real Estate Investment Trust. You've written this article, The Need for Climate Risk Disclosures, a case of physical risk of two REITs, EQR and AR.
So typically people will say climate disclosures are not necessary because climate is not a material risk. So it is hard to prove something that doesn't exist. So I tried to pick two REITs, the ones you named, who are pretty heavy on coastal property, meaning they have lots of properties on the various coasts, on California, Boston, New York, Florida, and so on. So it's somewhat hard to argue that at least physical risk is not a problem. But when I looked at the sustainability reports, it's actually pretty disappointing. There's nothing really there. They have like 30, 40 pages of glossy material, nice pictures and so on. So I was trying to find somebody. I mean, there are many of these physical risk consultants out there. And there's a company called Coastal Risk in Florida. You know, they did everything pro bono completely, you know, because I don't have the money to pay them. I'm, after all, a poor professor. So the nice thing about REITs is that they have addresses. So these guys actually sucked out the addresses and stuck them into their model and gave me some data of what is the exposure that the properties held by these REITs have to flood risk and certain other parameters, which I publish in the paper. Now, on the surface, it does look like there is obviously flood risk, right? But none of this is disclosed by companies. More important, I had a super difficult time translating all this to some kind of cash flow ranges. Because the other narrative that I often came across when I testified a few times for Congress was the other side will say, oh, the data is all there. You don't need anything. You know, it's all there. All material things are disclosed. I mean, really, if you tell me how to do it, I'll give you the data. Because it's not easy. So the company has to do some modeling itself and tell us what might the potential risks be. Because there are a gazillion business issues. So for instance, if you're going to flip the property within 5 or 6 years and let's say you're lucky enough not to have a hurricane Okay, you probably don't have climate risk in that narrow sense, right? But somebody else has it in the system. It's like passing the parcel. Or maybe let's say there's flooding and you have tremendous bargaining power and you're somehow able to pass on the costs of fixing the impact of the flood on your building to your renters, in which case there is no impact on cash flows because my expenses are now passed on to my customers without any major change in demand. How do I know all this from the outside? So there is need for businesses taking the overall risk, modeling it seriously, thinking about elasticity of costs and revenues to climate shocks. And if there is nothing, that's totally fine. I'm not saying there has to be a risk, or maybe the cash flows are negligible, but have you done the work in a rigorous way? And can you please tell me? It's perhaps the intent behind the SEC's disclosures too. And that intent is somehow missing. And the reason I wrote that piece was to say that, look, somebody pro bono, and like, and I'm a professor sitting here trying to do this. If I can get this far, how come you guys with like, you know, $1 billion of valuations and so on can't do this? And why doesn't it show up in your sustainability report?
Speaking of billions of dollars, next up is insurance. And you've written several interesting articles. The first one is ESG default insurance, especially regarding REITs and so on. That's pretty cool. And then the next two ones is incorporating climate risk in underwriting insurance or even in the investment portfolios of several major insurance companies like AXA, Chubb, Liberty Mutual, and Travelers.
So this ESG default, I'm glad you picked up on that piece, ESG default risk insurance, because I thought it became so technical by the end that I lost everybody. The basic idea I was trying to communicate was, what does default mean in ESG? If you default on a loan, it's pretty obvious there are mechanisms out there to enforce this, right? You don't pay interest, you don't pay principal, we do something bad to you. At the very least, we renegotiate the conditions called covenants. ESG, I'm not sure who's enforcing default, who's checking these things is one point. And I was trying to argue for something like a cat bond structure for ESG, meaning, or think of even more simple, think of, say, directors and officers insurance. What is that? If you join the board of a public company, at least in the US, it's a very litigious place. You're worried about the fact that somebody will sue you because you were negligent, and somehow as a director, because of your negligence, some kind of fraud happened, and somehow the shareholder lost a lot of money. So to protect yourself from that eventuality, you could go and buy directors and officers insurance. Unfortunately, that number is not publicized in the US. I wish it were, because it's a good governance tool. Because if somebody outside is charging you more for D&O insurance, then that's telling me that the insurance company thinks that the risk in your company has gone up. So it's trying to come up with some mechanism like that for ESG. That's maybe the simplest way to put that, because it was quite complicated. It's like a credit default swap, if you want to argue one more mechanism for the world of ESG, right? Because you're betting on the fact that the company may default. There's a price on that. There's a dynamic price on that. So if you're SVB, and if there were a credit default swap, it would have massively gone up leading up to the crisis. So it would have served as an early indicator and so on, right? Because markets are good at these things if there are instruments to price these risks. Now, the general commentary about the state of US insurance, right? So there, the usual conflict in this space is Republicans at least will talk about values and value intersecting. They want to see value, right? So I thought, oh, insurance is like the ideal place, right? That's the place where values and value should intersect, meaning, you know, it hurts their pocketbook if there's a climate crisis. They have to pay out a bunch of stuff. So I just wanted to understand how that industry worked. And actually, I learned a lot from that piece. I was like, wow, I was disappointed in some sense. Because, I mean, I just did a simple, just to kind of lay of the land kind of analysis. That's where I start, right? I pick the one control sample, which I picked AXA as my French counterpart. Of course, they do more reinsurance. I know they're not exactly the same as the US. And then I picked the top 10 US property and casualty insurers and simply looked at their discussion of climate risk, both on the asset side and the liability side. What does that mean? The liability side, they actually write policies. So if something goes wrong, they have to pay policyholders. So that's why it's an obligation. On the asset side, they have a whole bunch of investments. What are they doing about worrying about climate risk and factoring those investments? By and large, I found there's not a lot going on in the US. You know, some people don't even bother with the sustainability report. Some do, but then it's like full of irrelevant information. Why is that? Whereas AXA is just amazing. Whatever you may say about French companies and so on, the number of data points they give you, the amount of work they seem to be doing to understand this was just very impressive. So we really stood out in contrast. And finally, I concluded, what is my working hypothesis for why things are the way they are? American businesses, at least the insurance businesses, are basically 1 year cost plus contracts, meaning they write P&C for 1 year, property and casualty, as opposed to, say, life insurance risk, which they write over, obviously, your whole life. So there is some pressure on them to hire actuaries, or at least model longevity and mortality as a portfolio, if not for any specific individual. There's no such pressure in the world of property and casualty, because they take last year's losses, subtract what the reinsurers would pay them. That's where the Europeans are worried, because most of the reinsurance is being done in Europe. And then whatever is left, they usually just spread that over the rate base. So if you have 200 million customers, everybody pays a little more. Effectively, it gets socialized. So even if there's a problem in Florida, somebody sitting in New York is paying for it, obviously, in some way. And now then, why bother with anything? You can say without batting an eyelid that climate's not a problem, because you have a cost plus model. And to turn this around, for all kinds of reasons, not necessarily just climate, but insurers are leaving Florida and California. Partly, they claim it's excess regulation and so on. But this analysis, I think, adds a piece to that debate by saying that if you really did some climate modeling as though you were selling a life insurance policy and you were looking 5, 7, 10, 15 years ahead, perhaps you would have organized your business differently. And perhaps the disclosures would have made you change how you run the business. So before you argue that climate risk disclosures are useless, are they useless because you've structured your business such that it's a cost-plus model? Or are they useless because they're really useless? You know what I mean? So they've effectively hedged climate risk in such a brilliant way because it's a cost-plus one-year model. Why bother with the tool that's supposed to make them think harder about hedging that risk? It was quite an interesting thing. And I got a lot of flack for that, I must tell you. Since this will be public, and the insurance companies that came after, we know who they are. That was disappointing, but that's okay. Thank God I have time.
I look forward to future research regarding climate risk insurance, because I've struggled with getting interviewees focusing on that. And I think that there's a real need for it. So I really appreciate your work on this. We're now reaching near the end of the interview, and I'd like to end the interview with advice for the next generation. So more like advice for the next Dr. Rajagopal, Dr. Rajagopal 2.0, if you can think of it that way. What advice would you give yourself? And there are two things. One, in the beginning of the interview, you mentioned about the abstraction between macro and micro, and how you would like to delve onto that. And second is, I really like this article, What Skills Should Finance Students Seek to Acquire in School? And you mentioned this term, there is a crying need for students and professionals who are skilled in accounting, financial reporting, and a basic sense of economics. So I'd like to hear your thoughts and advice here.
So let me tailor that for the sustainability world. So again, a lot of these things seem to happen in silos, in the sense that when I meet sustainability people in practice, they're very nice people, they have great values. Many of them come from some kind of development economics, Peace Corps type background, but they don't understand finance, they don't understand law, they don't understand economics very well. And they don't understand there's no free lunch. Life is a series of trade-offs. The perfect is the enemy of the good. You often hear statements saying, oh, we will tax the company. There is no such thing as taxing the company. The company is a legal fiction. It's a collection of contracts between customers, suppliers, the taxpayer, shareholders, creditors, and employees. So what does that mean? You're basically taking money from somebody's pocket. So it's good to understand whose pocket and where. So the big idea being, we need cultural translators, people who will subtitle, if you will, if you go watch a movie, what the climate people are saying to the money people and what the money people are saying to the climate people. So that's what I meant by, you need some folks who would end up becoming the bridges, if you will, between these two relative silos, the climate engineers, the sustainability professionals, and the accounting finance types who understand numbers and who have a lot to contribute to the conversation. Because right now, they stick to their world, right, which is like dollars and cents, but they have lots of valuable skills in terms of internal controls, rigor. A lot of that is missing in the world of sustainability reporting. It's like loosey-goosey. Sustainability reports come out like 1.5-2 years late. Can't do all that in a financial statement. Otherwise, the SEC will be after you. And markets will be after you, even if there were no SEC in that sense. The first point you made about advising, giving advice to the next generation, even my graduate students don't listen to me. So I'm not sure how much your audience will listen. But I often tell people, work on things that people care about. It's a big problem in academia, by the way. As I said, a lot of us are working on questions that nobody wants answers to. There's a lot of navel-gazing research. So work on something that somebody besides you and the referee and the editor cares about. Otherwise, being a business school academic is such a privilege. Unlike engineering and medicine, where these folks have to run around, raise grants and so on, you know, most business school research is funded through student tuition. And in an ideal world, student tuition should lead to curiosity-driven research because we don't have to go fight for money. Thank God the money comes. But sadly, I think what's happened is that to some extent, it's become accountability-free research. That we are increasingly making up questions to come up with answers, whereas the real world is struggling with big problems, right? How do you measure ESG? What do you do with the ratings problem? How do you deal with proxy issues? There are like hundreds of problems to worry about. And academics can add a tremendous amount because we may not have a lot of practice in terms of what happens in the trenches. But A, we are somewhat impartial. B, we are trained to look at data. And C, we are hypothesis testing machines. We keep coming up with ideas. It doesn't work with the data. You refine your hypothesis, and that's how you understand the world. So that thinking and discipline has a lot to add in terms of both policy conversations, products to create, to solve problems, and so on. Somehow, that full potential never gets realized. The amount of human capital in my world chasing questions that are irrelevant to anybody is quite a lot, sadly. At least in the world, in everything, in macroeconomics, in the world of investing, the macro guys and the quants are not going to go away because there's so much new digitized data, right? But the macro guys, you know, at least in my view, in my world, whatever they can't explain, they will dismiss as noise. But the action is in the noise. The micro people understand specifics of companies, specifics of institutions. And my hope is that we can move to a place where we can make the macro models a little more granular, more context specific, and hence make them better. And hopefully teach some of the micro, and frankly, there aren't too many micro people left, at least in things like fundamental analysis and 10Ks and so on. But hopefully all the rich institutional frictions that you get to see at the micro level, when you think about companies and cases, sometimes gets lost in the world of macro. So my hope is that we can come to a world where we can marry these two things, because the pace of digitization is only going to go up. Virtually every piece of information about most of us in the near future will be on some kind of digital archive. So the potential to mine those data sets for rich insights is tremendous. But at least in finance, the quants and the macro people are living with very reductionist theory, very simple models of how the world works. The world is very complicated. So we are going to have a far more fruitful conversation if the macro models came down to earth a little bit and try to look at some of the granularity and the nuances and the detail.
I've really enjoyed this interview with you, and I'm sure all the listeners will appreciate it. All the articles I've mentioned are going to be in the show notes, so everyone can access it. Thank you very much, Professor. Have a great day in New York.
You've been very, very kind, and I've never met someone who's as prepared about everything I've written. So thank you for your diligence and for giving me a platform to talk about some of these ideas.
Thank you for doing all the research you do. Awesome.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Climate Finance Podcast. For future episodes, please join our mailing list on www.climatefinance.xyz. I repeat, www.climatefinance.xyz. See you at the next episode.